I think that was a brilliant discussion. So many questions. I will do my best to reply. I won't be able to reply to every point everybody made, but, you know, or we'll miss the clapping if I do. I'll try and sort of group things together. I'm going to start with Duncan's question about when will it happen and where, mainly because I don't know the answer to either of them. I don't think from the history of revolutions and uprisings and mass struggles, anybody ever knows exactly when they'll happen or where they will happen. I do know, like, that old Lenin was sat in Zurich in Switzerland, spoke to a meeting, probably about the same size as this one, of the of Swiss young socialists at the beginning of 1970. He said, "We of the older generation are going to live to see the revolution," or some words to such effect. And, you know, a month later, it broke out. He didn't know, and I don't know. However, even though I can't answer that, I think if you look what is happening in the world, generally, the big picture of what is happening in the world, we see that we are heading on, for many reasons and in many ways, to a major confrontation, to a major uprising, or something of that kind, two revolutionary situations. And I don't mean this will happen next month or next year. I mean, in historical terms, that's where we're heading. First of all, if you look at what happened in the last year or so in politics, before the pandemic kind of closed everything down, because that's a different, you know, that kind of put a damper on everything. But if you look what happened around the world last year, you'll find that two things, there were two trends, two tendencies. One, there was a large-scale revolt from below in places that you might not have expected it to happen. In Chile, in Lebanon, for example, in France with the Gilets Jaunes, in Ecuador, in Haiti, in Iraq, I'm probably missing some people, you know, but in all of these places, there were huge revolts from below, seemingly like coming out of nowhere, against the inequality, against the neoliberalism, expressing mass anger on people. But there was also serious moves to the right, you know, perhaps most importantly, you had a move to the right of the Indian government under Modi, extremely reactionary in the second biggest country in the world in population terms. You had the semi-fascist Bolsonaro in Brazil, again in a huge and very important country. And of course, we know about Trump, and we know about Johnson and so on. So you had, I think, a temptation is always to say, is it moving leftwards or is it moving rightwards? Actually, it was doing both. It was polarizing. We're getting both sort of things happening. Then, on top of this, you then get the COVID pandemic, which means that we face a triple crisis. The system faces a triple crisis, and we'll face a triple crisis. COVID in the immediate threat to the lives of millions of people. Consequent upon that, an immense economic crisis, the like of which we have not seen since the 1930s, and it may in some ways be worse than the 1930s. Now, let's be clear, the trigger of this is the COVID crisis, but not its root cause. The root cause, that this recession that we're going to enter, or it may be a depression, even bigger scale, has been on the cards and developing and just being held at bay by the system. But that is going to hit us. And I would say, respond to Sam and say, whatever debates about consumerism in the past, in this recession, what we're going to see, unfortunately, is mass unemployment and mass impoverishment of people. The problem is not going to be that people have too much to consume and are distracted from struggle. The problem is going to be that they're going to be unemployed and ground down. If people don't struggle, it's because they're being smashed by the recession, not because they're bought off. Because and this is going to be not just in Britain, this is going to be global. It's going to be terrible in America, for example. Absolutely terrible, I think, in terms of the impoverishment of people. All the kind of emergency payments and so on that they brought in to try and deal with the lockdown and make the lockdown acceptable to people. These are going to start getting withdrawn. Tapered was what the Irish government called it. They're going to taper them. But in other words, they're going to withdraw them and cut them, and then people are going to be back in terrible poverty. And our job as socialists will be to defend their interests as best we can. But that's happening. And then at the same time, we have the third element in the crisis, which is climate change. Now, of course, we can look and say, well, as the system grinds to a halt in the lockdown, this seems to be good for the environment. Yes, it is good for the environment, actually. But remember that our rulers will be determined to get out of this as soon as possible and go back to business as usual. And the business as usual that they're going to go back to is trying to restore levels of economic growth, capitalist economic growth. They're going to be trying to restore profitability, and the consequences of that will be in terms of the world and climate change absolutely catastrophic. There was a report in The Guardian just the other day that said that the course we are on is going to lead to a billion people in the world. A billion people in the world living in places where the temperatures are too high for them to be livable in. You know, over average temperatures in the 90s, which means high temperatures in the hundreds and so on, which is unsustainable for people. And you're talking about, you know, three quarters of India, Central Africa and so on. These places are going to become too hot for people. Just imagine that is going to mean. So you get a situation like that, and you get mass refugees and so on. You'll get what we're going to get is we're going to get revolts of working class people from the left, but we will also get fascist reaction from the right, and it will be a struggle as to what happens. So that I think is what we're looking at. I'm sorry, Duncan, I can't tell you that it's going to be in South Africa in 2021 or whatever, but I think it'll be in such places and we don't know where, but I think that all these mass struggles will erupt in all sorts of places we may not be expecting. The place I hope for most is China, because in China you have 500 million workers, you have 100 million workers in Guangdong, and they have such power, you know. So that's what I think. Now the next set kind of thing I want to address, looking at the time, Jesus, the next thing I want to address is how it happens and what revolutions look like and how it deals with the state and so on. And the first thing I want to say here is the important thing to understand is that a revolution which begins with the masses entering into history, as Trotsky said once, you know, starting to take action on the streets and in the society and take control. It's a process. It isn't something that happens on one day or one week or a fortnight or a month. No, it's a process. It's likely to be a process that unfolds over months and even years, but it's not an indefinite process. It's not, you know, something that takes 20 years and just happens gradually bit by bit. No, a revolution, a social revolution, is something that is a struggle. And many of the questions about how you take things over or don't take things over or what happens and get solved in life. I mean, we tend to talk as if, do we have a plan? Do we have a plan for workers' councils? No, what happens is that in mass struggle, people start to organize themselves. When they start to organize themselves, they have popular assemblies of one form or another. And then it becomes, can those popular assemblies take over? And the same sort of thing will happen about the MI6, the special branch, the MI5, and all the rest of it. It's not you elect a socialist government, or a socialist government comes to power, even in an uprising, and then they have to decide, what do you do about MI5? What will happen is there will be in the process, struggles against the cops and the forces of the state. And they will be, if the revolution wins, they will be cleaned out and cleared out. Jeannie mentioned the example of the Portuguese Revolution, where a lot of that happened, and then you had a process that you, the word was saneamento, cleansing of the state. I'm going to give a different example because it's much more recent, and it's one where I was quite involved with the people, not actually in the street fighting, but I was involved before and afterwards with a lot of the people. And that was the Egyptian Revolution of 2011. Now, it starts, all right, with a completely unexpected, took the revolutionaries completely by surprise. They didn't expect it to happen. It starts with millions of people coming out into the streets, mainly because of, there was also a revolution in Tunisia before, and they were inspired by it. And they went to the main square in Cairo, Tahrir Square, in their hundreds of thousands. And the Egyptian police did what the Egyptian police had always done faced with mass demonstrations, was try to batter them off the streets. And this time, instead of people being battered off the streets, more people joined them and they fought back. And there were several days of street fighting in which the police were broken. They lost. And they fled the streets, and police didn't dare show their faces and so on. And there were all sorts of conflicts. And after 18 days of this, the dictator of Egypt, Mubarak, was forced to resign, and he was arrested and so on. And so in that sense, the revolution won. But here, when that happens, then you start to get political problems. Right, and the political problem, then what replaces it? Where do you go from here? And here the question of the role of a revolutionary party is extremely important. There were a few people, Egyptian revolutionary socialists, many of whom I knew were absolutely splendid people, but they weren't big enough, they didn't have enough roots and so on. What happened in this situation was people turned to, the millions of people, don't go to meetings like this, turned to the main opposition party, which was the Muslim Brotherhood. This was not a turn to religious fanaticism. This was a turn to the reform option. And what did the Muslim Brotherhood do? The Muslim Brotherhood tried to exist with the existing state. They tried to exist, they tried to make friends with and do a deal with the military. So they shored it up. The police, having been driven off the streets and so on, they came back and they did a deal with them and they tried to run the system. They were, in fact, rather like the British Labour Party in some respects, the Muslim Brotherhood. And what then happened was that all the existing powers in society, the big corporations and the state and the judges and so on, gradually undermined them and reduced them to a shambles. And then there was a popular movement against them because they were being forced to turn against their own people. And then the right wing, led by the military, were able to stage a coup and smash the whole thing. So, in other words, in those situations, the real problem is a problem of politics and the political consciousness of the masses. There were large numbers of Egyptian workers who had their political consciousness grew by leaps and bounds, and they believed almost they could do anything just by standing in Tahrir Square. But they needed more experience, they needed to absorb the lesson of previous revolutions and so on. They needed a revolutionary party. And this comes back to the question, I think it was Jane who raised, about the role of individuals. Because you are talking, as well as talking about how mass consciousness changes through mass struggle, like in Tahrir Square, we're also talking about creating an organization of individuals in the first instance, and then groups of workers before, who become the memory of revolutionary struggle, who know about revolutions, who know about the Paris Commune or the Russian Revolution, who know about what happens in a revolution. You can't stop halfway and so on, and are able in that situation to carry the class of working class as a whole forward. And so the individuals who may be won by reading a book or looking at the state of the world or seeing videos or coming to meetings or lots of the little struggles, you know, you meet them doing the mutual aid or whatever. I'm running out of time and I can't cover all the points I want to make. But all those little things local strikes in your work, but the bringing to drawing together of those individuals into an organization and the pooling of experience, that is crucial for the victory of the mass movements in the revolution. And now, I will stop by saying that if we go back to our original question, can workers run society? The answer is yes, they can, but it's not inevitable they will. It's going to depend on winning the struggle in the momentous times that we live in. I'm not talking about next week. I'm talking about the next, 5, 10, 15 years, because we are in a situation now on a world scale where if we don't, we'll face barbarism. That's the choice. So I would urge everybody to get involved, band together, and work for a socialist solution to this great crisis of society. Thank you.
Thank you, John. That was excellent. And it was, fantastic meeting. And